I know that there's, I think some of, do you all of you have handouts at the moment?
We didn't take one.
Oh, here comes someone. So some of you heard, as several people came up to me, we've been working really strongly that this course become, as I said on Monday, both something that began in February is doing, we're working on it this week, and then we're going to do some more in late July and early August. And what we're working on is a larger range project around the future of worship. So we've really been grateful that staff here at Holden have been participating in that. But staff also has a meeting tonight at 6:45, so they will be leaving. I've asked them if they could be as loud and protesting as possible. Three things that I'm interested in us doing together this evening. One is to review a little bit on what we did together on Monday, if you have had some additional thoughts. Secondly, I want to pause and talk a little bit about what is not quite rightly phrased as definitions of worship. Coming out of looking at a bunch of historical things on Monday of what worship does, tonight I'd like us to talk out loud about what we think worship is. So this is not a technical definition that we want, but we want a bunch of people putting their heads to work on this. You will see that I bring from what we did on Monday and from other places some ideas myself, but what I'm bringing has a fair amount of contradiction in it. So we'll need to not accept what I present in that regard at face value. And then finally, and for the most part, what we're wanting to do tonight is think about the decline of American worship in the 20th and 21st century, and especially in the last 15 years. So this is the only of the three classes this week. This is the only one that will do some substantial negative work. Not wanting to be negative, but wanting to think about what's going on in worship in America. And I say America only because that's what I know a little bit about. I think that for us to make larger statements would be hard than just our country, although I will probably try to do one or more comparisons. So that's what I'm wanting us to do, and I'm hoping that those of you who may not have been here on Monday night, I'm trying for this to be as dialogical as possible, almost a seminar, as we go along. So please join in wherever you want to and wherever I invite you. So now I'm not going to say anything more about the first paragraph of the handout. If you weren't here, please look at it. That's just kind of where I have come from in what worship is. But and just to then say in the second paragraph, so this is this week a second of three stages of looking here at Holden at the future of worship. We're wanting to have this in its own integrity. We're in each of the times repeating some things, each of the 3 weeks we do this, but most of it will be new and more for us to be thinking about together. But what we did on Monday night, here I'm reviewing the conversation we did where we were thinking about our playful meandering in past deep rituals. That is, we wanted to playfully look at the past of worship. And there we did two things. One, we provided two sets of words for past worship. One was value, worth, work of the people, and bread. That all came from actually ancient words for worship. And so here, I'm wanting us to think about what worship can be now and what it is for us and is not. So I want to just go over and just give us a moment here to say, what does thinking about worship as value, worth, work of the people, and breath? What did you learn about that on Monday, and what have you thought about it in the past since then? Or what, even with the question right now, what is, do any of those words strike you as all wrong, partly wrong, a good idea, or something you've learned from? Well, that'll come back up. The second three words that's here are the three words that I gave to the title of this three-part engagement. Energy, emotion, and awe. Three words meant to describe major things that I think have happened in worship over the past 10,000 years. Energy, emotion, and awe. Here I'm going to hold you a little bit more to saying something. So in your experience, how much is worship energy, emotion, and awe? Or in what you see others doing well in worship or powerfully, how do those words fit and what do they miss? Yes?
Picking up on energy a little bit, I think part of what I look for in worship is just being around the energy of other people that have come for hopefully similar reasons.
Thank you. Yeah. So that would be a particular kind of communal energy.
I mean, so much of our lives anymore seem like we're isolating ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's got their little tablet or a little phone that they've got their head in. But when you come to worship, you're more aware of the people around you, I think.
And we talked a lot about on Monday night about the communal character of that and the energy that can bring. Yes. Brenda.
When I think of worship, I so often think of learning, which is very different than the idea of liturgy. But I think it comes in when it seems to me something missing for these words when I think about liturgy is meaning, meaningfulness, significance, the power of insight to understand.
Yeah, I really love that critique of these three words as whole. Because notice energy and emotion are affect and experience, as is awe to a certain sense. So I think that these three words are prejudiced towards experience and emotion and inner life or communal life. And now you say meaning. That's really helpful. I would want to say that energy, emotion, and awe don't have meaning, but they aren't meaning in and of itself. So for you to say the experience of having meaning or receiving meaning really helps us in that regard. Or what energy does for us has a lot to do with what things mean.
feel like I was raised in a tradition that was very suspicious of emotion because it could be manipulative, you know, to get a crowd in a frenzy, woke up over something. It's just too cheap and easy to do, and therefore, let's not go there, I suppose, was sort of the idea.
Yeah. And in retrospect, how do you think about that take?
Well, I think there needs to be a balance of, I guess, mindful. Mm-hmm. So you're not just being sucked into a crowd kind of, you know, everybody else is excited, jumping up and down, therefore I'll do it. Mm-hmm. But a sense of which there is a meaning to it. But yeah, I mean, if what we say is true, it should be exciting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If this gospel news is really, truly so wonderful, we ought to be behaving in a way that corresponds to that, rather than having no excitement, no emotion over something we claim is extremely significant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you picked up on something that I want to reread in terms of why I sought these entitled terms. It's because, of course, so much of the critique of worship of experience in the last 20 years is it's boring, it's mindless, it's not powerful. And so I'm pushing all of us and others that are in charge of worship or deeply involved in worship to double check ourselves on one of the main critiques, and that is that it doesn't have much energy, doesn't have much emotion, or doesn't have much awe. So I'm saying that mainly for you to see my process coming into this, and I love the fact that you noticed that you have a heritage of being of critiquing and being worried about there being too much emotion.
I think we've kind of cleaned it up, though. We don't have the incense burners anymore because it may affect some people with their breathing. Our church doesn't have Easter lilies anymore because some people are very sensitive to the smell. And so we remove smell kind of from our worship.
Oh, thank you. My son knows that I have not had supper.
Dinner.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Yeah. So in other words, you would say you're willing to double check yourself and us on how emotion and energy and awe could work.
We've taken the awe out of the incense coming around, mm-hmm. because that was hard for some people. And so in a way, we've kind of made it boring because we're kind of cleaning it up.
Mm-hmm. Coming here to worship at Holden is awesome and exciting because it's new. Each worship, I'm wondering, what are they going to do this time? Whereas where I worship usually, it's usually the same.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's something about a retreat setting that is a little bit exceptional.
So would you use any of those words for your ordinary experience of worship of energy, of emotion, and awe?
I think there's a place for bringing exceptional and unusual to worship, to make it a little bit like you're on the edge wondering what's going to happen next, mm-hmm. is helpful for me.
Yeah, and when I think back on what we were talking about on Monday, so I wanted to, when we talked about the early meals of the early Christ people, I wanted us to sink in that looks to me like it was a lot more emotional, a lot more energetic, and a lot more awesome than much of what we experience today. And similarly with Basna. Yes?
I was thinking about what you said about meaning and kind of tying that with emotion and our kind of suspicion of emotion, and I can't remember all of the parts, but there was a seminal article about ways of knowing that came out, and I think in my experience of ELCA Lutheran worship, we often rely very heavily on the cognitive way of knowing and creating meaning, and yet there are so many other ways to create meaning that are nonverbal, pre-verbal, felt experience, that we sometimes cut ourselves off from, and maybe we miss that opportunity. And then the flip side of that is that sometimes we feel that if we don't have a big emotional experience, worship wasn't good. And so there's a place for both. It doesn't mean it was an unsuccessful worship if I didn't have a mountaintop experience, a Holden Village experience in my regular worship diet. but there's a place for both, I guess.
Uh-huh. And Brenda, would you respond to that you were talking about?
Yeah, because you were talking about meeting. So
meeting. You want to say more?
This is
a really important back and forth.
I really appreciated your allusion to ways of knowing. There's a book written, Women's Ways of Knowing, by Mary Galenke et al. And that's very special. And so she identifies different ways women in particular understand what's true or what's real. And I couldn't agree more with you. The word significance does not necessarily mean or require mind or emotion, or rational or emotional response. But really, significance or meaning can come in such a variety of ways. And I think even the concern about cleaning it up, which I can really relate to, it feels sad to me, and yet I want to be inclusive.
Right.
We've got to figure out ways to reach out to people who know in different ways, who learn in different ways, experience in different ways.
Mm-hmm. And let me then double check with you on that, Brenda. So when you were adding meaning to this, you weren't necessarily putting that over against affect, emotion, energy, and all.
It's just that for me to have an experience of awe, there has to be a sense of significance and meaning.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel awe if it's not significant somehow.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But let me push back just a bit on that. Can you get meaning from an unexpected experience of awe?
Hmm.
Absolutely.
Okay. In other words, so the lovely thing about you adding the category of meaning, or I would say meaning making, to these three things is that it feels like it helps us notice that awe, energy, and emotion are categories of meaning making.
Yes, that's well said.
Okay.
Well said.
Yeah. And can I toss you a copy up there? We're working off a
I don't know.
I won't toss, but I'll walk it up.
Okay, thank you. On Monday we had someone
that was
so tall he could
just
handle it.
Oh.
That was really dramatic. Yeah.
More of a question, but where did ritual and symbol then work into this? In some parts of the church are very rich. And almost invite a mystery.
Right. For me, they are symbols and ritual are at the heart of energy, emotion, and awe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
There's a question over there.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
Oh.
When I saw energy, emotion, and awe, I thought of some mega churches, and one night, we were taking our normal walk on Alki Beach, and they were having Mars Hill, which has sort of imploded since then, but they were having this huge baptism on the beach, and it was full of energy, emotion, and awe, but that wasn't enough to sustain that model of church for the long run.
And it's interesting for me.
I mean, we got really caught up in it, ASAP and I, because it was very... emotion, and it was really an amazing experience in lots of ways.
So let me explore that with us all. It seems to me that Regular Protestantism is not very big on those three categories, but Evangelical Protestantism is.
And Pentecostal.
And Pentecostalism as well. So I love your experience in that regard to notice that that had a bunch of things. Well, no, let me ask this. Did that, was one of the things that brought you, although it didn't bring you far enough, did that bring you something that you were missing from regular Protestantness, or was that a factor for you?
I don't think that's a factor, because our church in Seattle is pretty unique, but I was engaged, and I think it was very special moment to see these young people be immersed and then come up, and there was a real sense of awe there. I mean, and we were just taking our normal nightly walk and kind of walked into it, and then ended up hanging out and talking to them and stuff. But so yes. Yeah.
I want to return to the notion of ritual, because I think there is something really important in being able to go to an experience, to be able to repeat that experience over and over again so that it becomes familiar to you. I hesitate to use the word comfortable, but I think it's really good when you're not flipping through the hymnal 5, 6, 7 times and you're having to look at a lot of sheets, but to try and encourage new members, if they come one Sunday and then they come another Sunday, it starts to become familiar. And the same thing for those of us who are longtime Lutherans. We get to a setting, we learn it, and then it's familiar to us.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something fairly awesome about that. It ticks your emotional energy, I think. And so I think that makes it friendlier for people when we do have this sense of familiarity.
Yeah, I want to really focus in on that in a minute in terms of how ritual and which I would say partly is both familiar and regular, but also tinged with something one doesn't quite understand. But I want to get back to that in a minute. Would you also say that familiarity of worship and ritual also is routinized?
It depends how long the routine lasts. You know, at our church, our routines last maybe 9-10 weeks, a liturgical season at the longest, and then we change the routine. So it's not the same thing over and over and over and over again.
Great. Yes.
I find that anytime I listen to someone who is speaking from the heart, and really doing it in the present moment about what relates to present life, I think then you always have energy and emotion and awe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And does that happen often to you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
In a regular worship setting?
Yes.
Great, wonderful. Because I would say, that especially in going into churches to help them think about their worship, or to in national settings, I keep hearing people, especially younger people, saying, man, all of this stuff you all are doing is really without great emotion, relatively boring and staid. So I'm, in other words, because, and I'm laying this here, and we'll get to this in a moment, in a few moments, I want us to notice how problematic worship is for so many people right now. And we'll get to that in a minute, Ron.
Yeah, I don't want this to sound like an excuse, because it's not. It's just more of an observation. But look what liturgical services are competing with for the attention of young people.
We are going to. Yeah, exactly.
Because we're really up against some very stiff, talented competition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
attractive.
Yeah. And we'll, when we get into the critique, we'll need to think a lot about that. I want to move us on, you know, after this.
I was just going to add, and maybe this is infused in what we've already talked about, but the power of music in the experience of worship.
Yeah. And for me, those three words are all about, I mean, there's so much of music in that. And I would say that in a bunch of American worship now, in Christian worship, they aren't. In other words, there's a whole bunch of kinds of worship today which have music that is so routinized that it can't get to the emotional or the energy or the awe. Okay, I want to just press a little bit here on a couple of things that come from folks that have been working on defining worship or ritual. And I want to just suggest how this may come from some of the things we've talked about so far. So I'm reading still in the reviewing. What do we think about worship, liturgy, or ritual? I'm packaging those for the moment. As, here's what I've said, and it's right there in front of you, a particular kind of social intelligence that intuitively plays with differences and change. Now, this is actually, I could give you the history of this, but I think this fits with a lot of what we said last time. And so here I want to say, does that make sense to you in your positive and negative experiences of worship to think of it as something that for a long time has been a particular kind of social intelligence? And I'll say what I mean by that. That means the kind of intelligence comes from being together and being about what is going on in society. So a particular kind of social intelligence that intuitively plays meaning doesn't explain and doesn't actually be didactic, but rather playful. We saw a bunch of those playful things on Monday when we looked at that. That intuitively plays with differences and change. Now, so just to say that the folks that have been working most on this definitionally are saying that ritual and worship want to tell you nothing is changing. Wants to make you comfortable so that you can relax and open your heart. It actually is the way worship makes people comfortable and unguarded is a way to actually sneak up on us helpfully in the way we deal with deep difference and change. So this is a question then for you. How much does saying that, and frankly, nothing is at stake for me, but I know that this is so much guiding a lot of new thinking on worship that I want to hear how you think about it. What do you think about that being worship doing that?
I would definitely say that is true for me. But then you have this whole body of younger people, people that come and they just want the contemporary band. They don't say the Lord's Prayer, they don't say the Creed, they just, And that is the worship for them, that speaks to them. Mm-hmm. But it wouldn't for me.
Uh-huh.
So the difficult part is how does a church serve both? And you have to have two different kinds of services.
Okay, but so what you just said is so wonderful for me in this discussion. What I want to say is, what if what you do and what they do is this? Mm-hmm. In other words, what if both of them are sneaking up on their constituency by making them comfortable enough to relax and have the serious questions about difference and change be on the table.
Yeah.
Not explicitly, but right under the surface in powerful, symbolic way.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think it's kind of an age thing. So I'm afraid that, you know, people my age, when we're gone, will that same kind of liturgical worship still be going on, or will it be the more contemporary? Which I guess it doesn't matter because I'll be gone.
They'll miss me too because I'm probably older than you. But let's stay with that. I guess one of the things we were noticing in a amazing brainstorming on Monday night was that worship is always changing with particular constituencies and situation. So I would want to say, welcome to the crowd. And if we look easily at any set of histories, there's all kinds of change going on. But I do myself share with you the worry, but yeah, thank you. So let me wait for some other answers on this possible way of thinking about worship. Ron?
I'm thinking about your statement. I'm struggling a little bit. I'm on both sides of it because on the one hand, the biblical, the lectionary that we read is quite challenging. And anybody who pays attention to what we read on Sunday morning should be quite challenged. On the other hand, I think pastors quite often try to keep everyone in the comfortable position. And I'm not sure they really capitalize on that opportunity once they have the congregation ready, receptive for a challenging thought, to deliver that challenging thought to them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure they actually do that. And it might be because they feel that that would not be well received. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So I guess part of me wonders I think Scripture does give us the differences in change that will challenge our lives. But I'm not sure the pastors often do as much with that as they could.
And the questions I'm wanting us to ask is without the particular pastor at stake.
Okay.
I mean, what's going on deeply in our larger cultures in worship, and what do people are they needing? And this would say that there's so much that in life, difference and change keep happening. It's always scary. And one of the things that worship does is sneak up on people to actually be able to have experiences of how they feel about difference and change without quite knowing it. Yes.
I think some of what, I'm sorry, I don't know your name, but you were talking about how you respond to one type of worship and maybe people of a different generation respond to a different type of worship. I think it's interesting to think that the function of those two types of worship is the same. It's just one type works for you and another type works for somebody else. So the function, I mean, is to get us into, I don't know, for lack of a better word, a meditative state where we're in a rhythm, we're moving, and then that releases some other part of us to wander around, right? And to find meaning, to find a felt shift. And for me, that's what constitutes successful worship, whether it be a really good sermon where the cognitive part of me, the verbal part of me, got some new meaning out of a scripture I've heard 100 times but didn't really quite hear it that way before, or maybe the music was particularly wonderful and I had an emotional response. Whatever it is, the function function is, it performs its function successfully if I leave worship having felt a shift that brings me to a point where I can move forward with energy on emotion.
And what I want to say is, when you say this, so you, when you feel a shift, and I would say, in as much as this definition holds, it, because it says the thing to that worship needs to be doing subliminally all the time is work on difference and change. And so the shift thing is really important. Brenda, I'm going to ask you to say something and then I'm going to go on.
Okay, it's about that word significance again. It seems to me that whether it's generational differences or cultural differences, our experiences that serve as a backdrop for what we bring to the worship are different in that different words and symbols have different significance.
Yep.
So it seems, if it seems to me that the answer to that sort of problem or observation would be to be able to focus on something that is true now in the present moment mm-hmm. for everyone mm-hmm. that has significance. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So I'm going to move us on in this, you know, wandering around. Frankly, what we just did is wander around the leading figures in the study of ritual and what it means. I can, anybody who wants to hear about those four theorists that did what I just described, please talk to me. I'm going to add another challenge here to see what you think. And this is a couple of people that I've learned from. I'm going to just read this out loud. Since the heart of worship evokes parts of life that are extremely powerful, frightening, and or ecstatic, it almost has to be, it meaning worship, almost has to be indirect, playful, transcriptive, hiddenly, I'll get back to that, implicit, artistic, impractical, imaginal, and or imaginative. So, I just a little bit about hiddenly transcriptive. This is James C. Scott in his work, and what he says is that that ritual has a hidden transcript that says things that hardly anybody dare say, and only implicitly and playfully. You'll read the next sentence. If one actually could speak directly and explicitly the specificities of power, fear, and or ecstasy in one's life, one would be in states of trance, collapse, frenzy, stupor, breakdown, and rapture. So in other words, what I want to say is that our lives are all powerful in negative and positive ways, frightening, and ecstatic. But we never can look at those directly because they're all so powerful, so frightening, and so ecstatic. So what I and the folks that I've learned from in this regard would say, therefore, if worship can get at all the scariness, the powerfulness, and the ecstasy of our lives, it has to do it in all these indirect, playful, hidden, implicit, artistic, impractical, imaginal, and imaginative ways. In other words, if we ever let ourselves feel all the power that's going on in our life, or the fear that's going on in our life, or the ecstasy that's going on in our life, we would be in states of trance, collapse, frenzy, stupor, breakdown, and rapture. Notice those are all devastating and wonderful things that are we couldn't control. So that's, I would like to see if anyone has some responses to that. In other words, I'm making a very strong case I'll say the next phrase. Worship is therefore rarely logical, rational, analytical, explicit, ideational, creedal, moral, or ethical when it works. Yes?
So is it worship also to somehow encounter the divine? And it seems to me that throws out all that logical stuff you have in that last line. One way, I think both of you have met Eric in the village. When he was 5 and his younger sister was baptized in Easter Vigil, I asked if I should bring him. Mm-hmm. The pastor very wisely said, bring him. He says, it's a service full of symbol. We don't know if we'll reach him with his intellect, but I believe the symbols will reach him. Mm-hmm.
No, that's exactly where we are, where this line of thinking is.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
We're
ready for you on trauma anytime.
Okay, that's what I was going to say, because this is great. So my background is I worked for about 10 years in inpatient psychiatry as a nurse. And so I've been studying a lot over the past years about what we're doing to help people heal from their trauma. And for a long time, the idea is you go to the therapist and you talk about your problems and you dig around in the dirt and you feel better. Except it doesn't work, right? It just doesn't work. It just re-traumatizes you. And so kind of the new thinking in trauma therapy is that what happens when we're traumatized is that we're so overwhelmed by emotion or a fight or flight response that we disconnect from that because we can't respond, either because it's not safe or we're physically not able to. And so the way to heal people who have experienced that kind of trauma is to allow them to fulfill a process that was interrupted, to go back and actually play out that fight or flight response by physically engaging, releasing emotion, and doing that in a safe way. And so it seems to me that a way to connect to this and a successful way to worship is to maybe take a card from the deck of trauma therapy, what we're learning now about how, you know, like people who have PTSD, soldiers, and those sorts of people actually are healing by not talking about it, but physically engaging, doing something to move their bodies, allow things to flow through that were interrupted and held and become festering wounds to release that. And so I think if we understand that, maybe that's the felt shift that I was talking about, is connecting all of that. And after you've had that felt shift and you've connected with the physical movement and the emotional movement, then you can come back with the cognitive part and analyze it later and add a layer of meaning onto the emotional and physical meaning that you've already had that's a nonverbal kind of experience, a nonverbal meaning, sometimes even a preverbal kind of learning and experience that is shifted and released. So I think we've maybe almost artificially created in some of our worship services this sort of talk therapy approach to worship, where we're all cognitive, we're all from the neck up about our worship. We read in a flat tone of voice from the lectionary. We read from a printed prayer with no inflection. We say the same things over and over, and we don't, we go out saying, yep, check that off, did my Sunday morning worship. Some other traditions, I think, maybe have a different problem where they're all from the neck down, right? So they have all the emotional response, kind of the big box churches that are doing all the entertainment with the big screens and so forth. It's all an emotional response with no cognitive piece to it. So if we could connect all of those pieces in a way that has meaning for individuals, whatever tool it needs to happen to make those connections, that would really be worship. Because that's a way to connect to the divine, right? To connect to what is most deepest inside us, what is our most authentic self that's untraumatized.
Thank you. So let's keep that really front. So one of the things that I am learning from theorists about the non-rational part of worship and the centrality of all of these other things, you have helped us on. So let's get some responses to this, just for you to say, I think there's too much preaching in worship for this kind of health. I love to be a preacher. Some of you just heard me preach several days ago. This is a thinking, this particular way of thinking about worship is a very strong attack on conceptualism as the key to worship. So let's have some, let's have some talk back to this in positive or negative ways. In other words, this really is a seminar, and we need to have, I'd love to hear some other voices in the room that say, don't we really need a lot of rationalism in worship?
The heart and the mind and the body are not separate. Right. They're integral. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think if you are kind of dancing around the feelings, then I feel that you're in a trance. Mm-hmm. The trance happens when you're not actually able to touch the stone of those feelings, and that's when somebody needs therapy. Mm-hmm. And so...
those are lovely categories.
So I think it's important that you make that connection between the heart and the mind in order to touch people that way. Mm-hmm. Because if you're just all in the mind and you're not touching the heart, then they're not feeling the full experience.
Thank you. Other comments?
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, my sister-in-law goes to Assemblies of God Church. So that's a certain tradition and way they worship and things. So when she came to our church in Seattle, which is certainly theologically very diverse from where her church is, she really liked the service. And I said, what captivated, besides the music, she loved the music, but what captivated you? And she said, well, it was the sincerity of the people's faith and longing for God that captivated her. So somehow she saw that in this totally different setting that if theologically she would not agree with a lot of things, especially on gay rights and things. Mm-hmm. But so I thought that was an interesting response.
Yeah. Some of the, and we'll see this tomorrow night, mm-hmm. when I'm giving a set of presentations on a bunch of different kinds of worship in our country now that I think are breaking into futures that might be helpful. And a lot of them are unusually combining what one might call Pentecostal evangelical and liberal artistic.
Interesting.
Yes.
I wondered if you had thought about embodiment. You know, the trauma.
Oh, how could we not have that as a part of what we're saying? Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, like the trauma response, so often success is experienced with yoga and the breath, and that's a big part of this discussion. And it just seems to me the physicality, the embodiment of how we respond to and express the awe and emotion and energy is really important to not just acknowledge, but celebrate.
Yeah, and on Monday we were talking about the early Christians in their meal, in which they're lying down together and singing a lot of songs and talking about really hard, difficult things. The body of Christ is actually bodily.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And our bodies.
Yeah. Right.
You know, I think sharing the peace is a really important
thing. This therapy I was talking about is called somatic therapy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Somatic therapy is really important. So I'm going to move us on, despite the fact that we have 7 or 8 thoughts in mid-air, right? We have not solved anything. But I want us, frankly, to get outside the very narrow boxes of talking about worship. And thank you, a bunch of you really have. So now I'm going to move us into the thing that is more mundane, and that's, this is discussion of contemporary worship, mainly the decline of people going to worship, and worship, the decline of worship in its quality and effectiveness. I'm going to just talk as usual. I'm going to present some things and then have you all respond back. And we did. This is why it's an hour and a half long, is because this is all common or collective work. Okay, so this is, and some of these things are, most of these things are assertions. Please argue with me. So here's just a playful analysis of the decline of Christian worship in the U.S. since 1870. He said, presumptively. So I want to say that between 1870 and 1960, there are a bunch of cultural phenomena, not worship programs, but things that happen in larger culture, American culture, that have made much difference negatively in what worship is now. First of all, beginning in the 19th century, industrial dominance, that is, our lives, are very affected by the whole new way American culture has happened with industrial revolution after revolution. Just want us to remember that that has been devastatingly disastrous and hurtful to so many people. I'm not saying that it didn't help the mechanics of this and that, but that on a spiritual and emotional level, it's very has been very dangerous. American materialism. I'm assuming that the fact that America became the world's good news of materialism has been very damaging to the spiritual life of people. And we can disagree on that. Scientific critique has taken on religion in some very destructive ways. I think of myself as a scientist in many ways, so I'm not downing scientists or science, but I am saying that the scientists have gone at religion and worship in ways that have been very damaging and hurtful to people and institutions. The world wars. So World War I and World War II, here's the first time I'm going outside of America, but what we know is that after World War I and World War II, Christian worship in Europe basically disappeared. I mean, I've lived and pastored in Europe, and you go to most of Europe on Sunday, and you, in a great cathedral, you find 23 old ladies, and I'm married to an old lady. I nothing against old ladies, but and when you talk to Europeans about the two world wars, they will say this revealed to us an impossibility of being a worshiping Christian. I mean, it's Christianity as worshiping is more or less gone.
The other side of that is that there was a significant immigration in America where ethnic groups found their identity in churches that they formed when they came here. So a lot of our religious experience is the other side of that.
Yeah, right.
Those people that came here found the churches to be their places and their homes.
In ways that the Europeans weren't doing.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly. So I want to say, yes, In other words, I'm listing the cultural devastations. So I do think that actually that's true, but also what happened inside European spirits and heads and bodies actually also is still inside ours. In some ways, and in some ways not. So anyway, I'm wanting to say, when I talk about, when we ask about the future of worship, I just want to notice that, and this is kind of what you were saying, Ron, there are a lot of things that have gone wrong that make it difficult for people in our country to do any kind of worship. Okay, I'm going to do two more and then you can talk back to these. The 1960s sociocultural revolutions and culture wars was the beginning of church decline in America. I am of that generation, and you can't get it out of me. But I want to say that the sociocultural revolutions and the culture wars that began in the 1960s have been damaging to what worship can be. In other words, there's so much culture war now going on that interferes with the possibilities of worship. Another assumption, it seems to me that from 1970 to 2000, there was increasing culture wars. There was the zenith of the U.S. evangelicalism. There was a steady and slow decline of so-called U.S. mainline churches. There was an emergence of non-Christian spiritual practice, especially Asian practice and sports practice, that took the place of how your body was holy. Everything from yoga to football on Sunday is what I'm talking about. So here I'm not quite yet talking about worship right now, but I'm wanting to say, look at these cultural things that have gone on. See where these three observations, where they make sense and where they are missing things.
I'm reading David Brooks' latest book. I forget
the second mountain.
Second mountain. Thank you, Melissa remembers.
Now you read the book.
It's a great book, and one of the things that that dawned on me as you're reading through this is the kind of the evolution of the postmodern movement. And it began, of course, as you described here, post-World War II, as sort of a questioning of the American institutions as a whole. Are they right? Should we believe them? Are the people who run them moral? Or are they being selfish? Are they manipulating us? And I think that's continued to evolve to the point where, you know, you consider kind of how we react to our institutions today. It's almost wholly with suspicion, isn't it? I mean, even to our all of our public institutions, our political institutions, we got calls to tear it all down from some. So it's sort of picked up momentum, steam. And I think sort of what you're describing here might be seen as the American churches being seen as just another one of those institutions. And the evidence for that might be in our media. Quite often, you know, you'll see a newspaper article that a pastor in I don't know, Oklahoma, some small town in Oklahoma, has been convicted of, molesting a child. And why is that news that I need to hear in Ohio? Well, because it's the church, right? It's the fact that he's a member of this institution, which is now under suspicion among many in our culture, that makes that news.
Well, it's confirmation bias. Yeah, because that's the narrative that is by some media is being spun that the church is bad because it fits with the narrative that, I mean, and it sells acts, right? I mean, people are interested in saying that.
Let me add one more thing, kind of on the flip side, is look at sports. Do we consider sports an institution? Not really, but we should. Mm-hmm. Football should be considered an American institution just like churches.
And you'll see a little bit later in our conversation, I'm proposing that it's actually worship.
Yes.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah.
I mean,
it acts like worship.
I think the other thing is that often for many reasons, mainline Protestant churches and the Roman Catholic Church have been seen as kind of the last holdout of cis-normative, heteronormative culture being the only right way and pushing back against any diversity in that way. And so many people are very turned off by that. It's not just that they aren't included, it's that the church is seen as pushing back as other people being wrong. I mean, I've cared for many suicidal adolescents who were queer, and they would come in, and it took me a while to realize that this was something that was being said to them by their churches. They were being told, and they were all using the same phrase, they were all being told they were an abomination before God. They were willing to end their lives because someone was telling them that God felt they were an abomination. And that's, I think that's a lot of the pushback, is the judgment that is coming from churches or perceived to be coming from churches.
Mm-hmm. Other comments on these cultural observations?
One of the cultural things I don't see in here that I think has affected the church a lot is the changing workplace. In having both, in the 50s, it was just the male that worked, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Females had the opportunity to volunteer, but now, by the end of the week, everybody's so tired.
Mm-hmm.
There's no place for worship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would put that in the category of other things. We recognize the stress of cultural developments. I'm not saying that there aren't good things, but
yeah.
Yes.
I think there's something else that's missing in your chronology. And that's any mention of the African-American experience.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's just not here, not post-slavery. It's not what's happened with worship.
Mm-hmm.
It's not with inclusiveness.
And
this is from a very limited perspective.
I've been an African-American pastor for about half my life. So could you add that for us? How would you characterize that?
Well, I think, you're going back to the 1870s.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's when slavery was, essentially eliminated. Obviously not, but
mm-hmm.
we had the civil rights movement in the 1960s. That, I think, influenced worship and how people worshiped. And even today, you look at some of the strongest churches in terms of membership, in terms of commitment, and many of them are largely African American.
Mm-hmm. And so could you say a little, this is very helpful, could you say where you see racism, creativity around race, worship-wise?
Well, I think there's a great deal of ethnic tradition that comes from African-American worship that we sometimes include, probably not very often. But there's a level of richness there that's missing.
Yeah, I think that's really powerful. Thank you for adding that. And I hope we can get back to that. Because actually the black church is also in deep trouble, worship-wise. Question, a thought back there?
Mm-hmm.
I'll move on then just to say a couple of things here. Just to say, I now want to say, so let's talk explicitly about, for a moment, what is clear in terms of the numbers that worship the American Christian worship is in rapid decline. By and large, as I see the numbers on that, since 1960, it's been slowly going down. And as of 2000, it's been quickly going down. So much so that this is one of the characteristics that hardly anyone acknowledges, and that is that evangelicalism is now in decline as well. It may not be in political decline, but all of the think tanks, all of the evangelical think tanks say we are in really serious decline in terms of how many people come to church. And it's in all of the polls as well about that. So that brings me to the trends in relationship to current worship in the last 20 years. And here's what I want to just say and see what you all think. Continuing materialism in the context of the decline of the middle class. Evangelical church numbers decline in the context of evangelical political power consolidating. Sexual violence impacts social Roman Catholicism. Secularism, individualism, and scientism are strong and explicit in what they are saying about one's identity. So here, just again, naming cultural trends. Are there other cultural trends that we need to name for worship? And are there some important counters to what I just said?
Yes. Well, I would say you have to look at where people are going. And so there's a big movement of Judaism, and especially in trauma-informed therapy. A lot of trauma-informed therapy is switching to a meditation-type mm-hmm. model of insight therapy. And so because God tells us to love our neighbor, Jesus showed us how to love our neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
Buddhism teaches you how to love your neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, as trying to learn to be a therapist and trying to learn to do the insight meditation, one of the things I have to do is a 7-day silent retreat. I can barely find them. I have to be on the internet the night before it opens to get a spot.
Mm-hmm.
So people are seeking what they can find in their heart.
Mm-hmm.
People are seeking that. So I think if we are just to focus on how we show the Holy Spirit and the love of God, then I think the church will be okay. Because
mm-hmm.
I think that's what people are seeking.
Mm-hmm.
They're seeking that connectedness and that love.
And talk a little bit about the powerful trend of Asian religious practice
mm-hmm.
and you feeling okay about Christian mm-hmm. categories.
Right, because Buddha is not a god, he's just a teacher. And Buddha will say that he is a teacher. But what he does is help you to reflect inside of what your feelings are, so you're not running away from them. You know, how to love other people. Metta, loving kindness meditation, things like that. And it's not secular, it's secular. But people are flocking to it in droves
mm-hmm.
because that's what they're seeing.
And I think you're saying that's helpful to them.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I think as a Christian, you can get that from the practice of learning to love Jesus and from the Holy Spirit.
And say a little bit about how you see the fact that it's happening more with Buddha than Jesus.
Well, I think it's because it's accessible, it's new, it's popular.
Mm-hmm.
It can be individual.
It can be individual. You can start with small meditations. You feel mm-hmm. a difference right away in the way you feel. And that's why those practices are being woven into the therapy models
mm-hmm.
in the hospitals. And with psychologists are all using those, leaning more towards those as a form of practice in psychoanalytical therapies that used to be used.
Thank you.
I guess...
Oh, yeah, I got one of you at the same time.
Religion feels more and more to me like tribalism. And I actually think there is something about an evolving unitary consciousness in our age that I listened to a service, I think it was maybe even a funeral, and there was a bunch of talk about being chosen people and the covenant and or the text, the scriptures. I'm not a cultural Jew, and more I don't want to affiliate with a tribe that leaves out others, that there's this chosen bunch. And I think there is something evolving in fact our survival depends on our sense of our deep connectedness to everything, not our own tribe. And so that's one thought I have. And another is the feminization of the church. Since we started Sunday schools, increasingly focused on things that happen in the home, like therapy and raising children and getting counseling. More and more, I think the question of authority of the church, I mean, it is no longer in many ways the masculine authoritative structures that it used to be, and I think in a still a patriarchal sort of anti-feminine archetypal culture that contributes to its loss of, or we get our therapy all sorts of other ways, you know, and so I get hung up on the book and the liturgies and the creeds and a lot of the knocking of the church, in my view, is rightly deserved. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. We focus on miracles and preposterous stuff when there is such other, you know, stuff that my 21st century brain just will not. I can't believe the earth is flat. I can't believe in a virgin birth. Mm-hmm. How could worship, or how could worship is an event. What is the lake? What is the nourishment that draws
right
to it? Doesn't just fence in a certain group. Mm-hmm. Can we name what that nourishment is anymore? That to do it an event, because I can be spirit person in the world without the event of worship, especially when it's tribal, exclusive, carries with it a bunch of really brutal cultural baggage. And my last point that I've been thinking is students will also say to me that a really beautiful book is boring. To each of us brings an assent, a willingness. So if I'm walking in with my scientific mindset in my sort of antithetical position about the authority of a book that doesn't capture me culturally, I will not give significance. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I will not. And I think more people do not come with an openness to be inspired and to be healed and to be in unity. There is an ascent that has to be there, where it's just we can turn cartwheels, and mm-hmm. people will not be filled with awe.
There's a lot there. Thank you. And what I want to just notice for what's going up, what we're hearing in this larger discussion, is we're acknowledging crises for Christian worship from the outside, crises in the inside, and some very strong contributions, new kinds of contributions from the inside of Christianity. You said a lot of that, so thank you. I'm going to move us on to the back of the page, and here I'm going to just say, just give a list of what I think is currently going on ritually and worship-wise in America. The first thing at the bottom of the front page is where I begin, and that's pro sports. I just want to say that look at the way pro sports fills people's sense of who they are religiously and in terms of meaning. Look at the way that happens. I mean, so it's the easiest to look at in terms of pro football, right? But people paint their bodies. They have rituals that are a very meaningful part of their life that happen daily, weekly, monthly, that says what matters to them and who they are. It is a sport that is violent. And the people that are having so much meaning gotten from that are people who also are victims of violence in so many ways. So for me, it's not at all accidental that the working class is the heart of the sports religion, because the working class is still under so much danger and so much violence. So that's the first thing I want to say. I'm going to ask for comments after I go down my long list. Rock concerts as ritual and worship and the work of the people. I actually make it my practice, not because I always like the music, although I sometimes do, but to go to these really big concerts and to see what's happening. And it feels to me like it's very religious and very spiritual. I mean, people carry each other. I mean, hundreds of people get carried in a worship service, literally, bodily, to express the oneness of everyone and the ecstasy of that. I'm not saying this is all great, but I'm saying it's happening. And a lot of people, for at least two generations, have really found worship. At least what I think we've been talking about as worship. What I call the screens and social media as ritual, worship, and work of the people. You see what I mean, Ron? When you were asking us to talk about this.
Yeah.
In other words, it seems to me now that people's bodies are very much in tune with a spiritual relationship to watching screens. I mean, many people just watch screens so much and get meaning out of it, and it defines them. When we watch so many people who are getting all kinds of communication, personal communication, communication of beauty and wonder and fear, it's through the screen. Bars and karaoke, so. We can talk about that or not. There is now a rapid decline in worship attendance in Protestantism and Catholicism. So I put, notice what I do, I'm putting these, how are people worshiping now? So this is the first time I've mentioned the churches, mainly because I think there are more other places that people are worshiping. There's a rapid decline in economic support for conventional Christian worship. One of the reasons that a whole bunch of worship in churches are bad is there's not financial support for it. The good things that one can do in terms of spiritual life, many of the churches don't have the skills to do it. If churches can rise to a beautiful, good, and wholesome worship practice in our day for all the different generations, most of them are too poor to do it well. By the way, someone was telling you, I forget who you were talking about, praise band. Well, praise bands are a real whether I say good or bad on this, what we need to know is that the powerful center of evangelical worship in the 1980s and 1990s is declining. Rapid decline in denominational identity, significant population shifts from denomination to denomination. So, I want to suggest that at least for a lot of the last 200 years, denominations helped people think about worship. And right now, denominations are very weak financially and in terms of their ability to do creative spiritual worship for their people and for others. That's part of it, yeah. That's part of it. But I would want to say the decline in economic viability in denominations is actually going further down more quickly than the amount of people going to church, which is also going back. There's a reemergence of church organizational emphasis on denominational doctrine and historical liturgical positions. One might think this is ironic. I'm a United Methodist, and you can't get a more messed up denomination than mine. I love my denomination too, even though it doesn't serve many of us well. But I want to say that the denominational hierarchy or the denominational bureaucracy is in full flight and defensiveness. We look at all of the denominations, and none of them have time to think creatively. They only think defensively. Because they're losing so much money, so many churches, and so many people. Who would want to blame the institutions that are trying to save their institutional skin when it's going so bad? I'm not blaming anybody, but it's really the denominations no longer in terms of worship. They can't do much except be defensive and that usually tries to raise up old boards. So there, in other words, all the denominations now are going harder at renewing old things in their own denomination than they were 40 years ago. There's this continued strength, and sometimes we talked about resistance, this continued strength in Asian-based meditation practices that is carrying the water for so many people. And some churches are saying, are trying to combine with Buddhist and Hindu and yogic practices. And some are defensive about it. This list isn't coming up with a grand scheme. I'm just wanting to name what I see going on in worship. It looks to me like Protestant servant and word-centeredness is unabated. By and large, the Protestants who always been best at making a long speech in the middle of their worship are still doing it. So the word-centeredness, which has such flaws in it, and had a little bit of a time in the middle of the 20th century, it's still working, but the people are declining, all the institutions are declining. There's eclectic and world music movements growing. So anyway, this is my laundry list of what's going on. And as we turn towards tomorrow, we're going to talk about how can worship have a future? I thought we should have this in mind. I've run over time. I'm sorry. I'm like a time Nazi. I apologize. Come back tomorrow, and we'll focus on what can we do.